So I thought I would introduce myself a little bit more. So again, come from the U.S. and was born in Washington, D.C. and lived on the East Coast a long time, but on the West Coast now maybe 25 years. Live in California, in Berkeley, California. My home base, really mainly a center called Spirit Rock, which is a pretty, anyone been there? Yeah, it's a pretty large center. We probably have 30, 40,000 people a year. And we have retreats all year round. And we also have, we really have two centers, a retreat center, and then more of a community center with other meetings. And, you know, the retreats are up to 2 months long. Those are the longest ones. Most of them are 5 to 7 days. Probably like here, you know, like at Aindor. You know. So, and I also teach at a more urban center in Oakland, California, which is called the East Bay Meditation Center, which has a very, has an emphasis particularly on diversity related to gender and race and disability and so forth. So there's a strong sort of justice emphasis, social justice emphasis there. And so my own, I think of my own background often in three ways. One is just very much learning traditional practice. And I have studied maybe for about 40 years and started studying with Joseph Goldstein, who has been here, and Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we had, I think, one or two years after I started, we had one of the famous Burmese teacher come to IMS, because I lived in Massachusetts. I went to Insight Meditation Society. Many of you know that. It's also a large center. And we had famous Burmese teacher come, named Mahasi Sayadaw, you know, great teacher. And we made a poster, you know, because I say, you know, Kornfield, Goldstein, Salzberg. We had big poster that said we had a picture of Mahasi Sayadaw walking in the on the road near the center, IMS. We said you don't have to be Jewish to teach Vipassana, which was a reference to, you probably don't, there was a at that time there was a famous advertisement for rye bread. And the advertisements showed like maybe a picture of someone Chinese background said, you don't have to be Jewish to love, you know, this company's rye bread. So this was kind of a joke, but very interesting. So I did a lot of retreats early on. This started in my early 20s. And I did many retreats and then started doing some teaching actually only after 2 years, but teaching more weekly groups and some classes, you know, and then eventually some short retreats and then later longer retreats. So I've been very, very much interested in traditional practice. So I have gone to Thailand twice, studied, you know, met Achan Cha, Achan Buddhadasa, some of the great teachers, Achan Mahabua in Thailand, and I think have been very interested in, you know, retreats, very, for me, very powerful, beautiful, probably in my life maybe 8 or 9 years in retreat, so long time, that maybe counting also, because I do once a week I do like a Shabbat, the Sabbath day. And I do practice all day, maybe last 35 years. So that's been important. If you add that up, it's a lot of years, just quiet practice. And also have studied in some Zen, but a lot of Tibetan practice also. Some of you maybe know Dzogchen Mahamudra. I think some teachers have come here in that. So that has influenced me a lot, some of the Tibet, and I still study with Tibetan teachers. So, and so that's sort of a first part of my background. Second part is also very interested in how we have this practice work in daily life in this kind of society, right? You know, I think maybe Tel Aviv not so different from California in some ways, right? You know, it's probably a lot of, you know, I better be careful and not make generalization, right? Okay.
You're touching an open wound. Tel Aviv is very different from California.
Okay. So I take it back. So we erased that on the recording. So,
but I think you don't be careful. Just feel at home.
Okay. Yeah, no. But I see, let's just say, some similarities, some differences. Okay, that's safe. Okay. So, so for me, but what I was meaning was the second emphasis is how does this practice of awareness and wisdom and developing a kind heart, how does that work when you have a job, you're busy, you have family, you have relationships, you are interested in social realities? You know, how do you do this practice? You know, it's not so clear from ancient tradition, right? It's not so clear. And so I've also been interested in how does daily life practice look like? What does it look like? And, you know, also very much involved with connection of psychology and meditation. You know, one of the areas I teach on, maybe not so much this weekend, is I call it transforming the judgmental mind. You know, that means, you know, the judgments of self or judgments of others, in the sense of being reactive, often negative judgments of self or other. And, you know, I will learn how that is here, but in the U.S., self-judgment is very common. You know, very common, and it's a hard aspect. So I've been interested in that area, but also how we internalize social judgments, like you know, gender, race, that sort of thing. And so that's a second emphasis. And then third emphasis, for a long time also been interested in how we connect inner work with social service and social change. You know, so I actually have a book that we brought here. I had friends bring, I brought some. I have a book that you can look at that's in the back room called The Engaged Spiritual Life. If you want to buy it, I will sign it. Okay, and so that's been a strong interest, and I particularly have worked with training programs for people working in the world, basically. And we've done training programs 6 months to 2 years long, and, you know, up to about 50 people at a time. You know, so that's been important, and we've learned a lot. You know, and I also taught one program that was more with a graduate school that was interfaith, that had, we studied Gandhi and Dr. Martin Luther King and Jewish prophets and Jesus and all how the different approaches to how you bring together spirituality and social change. And we did a whole 2-year program on that for about 9 years. So that's some of my background. Different interests. So really, one way to say it is that I really have an interest in a kind of broad view of practice that goes all the way from retreat, very focused, very, very traditional, to how does it work? How do we make it work in a contemporary world? So that's this weekend, mostly traditional. But we will have some emphasis on the other dimensions. But this weekend, as you know, the theme is on what I call the three ways of seeing that bring a liberating insight. And it's particularly on practicing with impermanence, practicing with in what they call in the text dukkha, or I like to translate that as reactivity. The mind goes like that. We call that reactivity. I will talk later about that. I like that reactivity is a better, for me, better translation in English of dukkha. The usual translation is suffering. And I think that can be confusing. I will explain that a little bit more. And then the third area is the teaching of not self, or anatta, which is really, what is the nature of the self? You know, a lot of confusion about this. So we will work with this for the whole 2 days. And basically, in a moment, I will give an overview of these three areas. And then we will have a little break, then come back and start with the rest of the morning on impermanence. And we'll be basically doing practices, doing sitting and walking meditation, focused on exploring impermanence. So a little bit different than usual instructions, right? This is more focused instructions on impermanence. But we have the basis is having the mind be quiet, a little more quiet, and then so basis in concentration and settling the mind, and then developing basic mindfulness. Maybe third step is then we focus on impermanence. So we have to have some settling, some concentration, step one. Then step two, we have just beginning mindfulness, being able to know what is happening. And then thirdly, then we focus on impermanence. So I will give practices, different practices that you can take home, and we'll also be recording it, so they will be available, so you could explore it really for the next period of time. That's the best way to learn it would be, say, okay, I study impermanence for the next week, and then 1 week with dukkha, and then 1 week with anatta. That would be a very good way to be here, you know, and have, because the learning really needs to take more than 2 days. You know, that's a very good model. Okay. So we will have the morning today on impermanence, and we will then continue in afternoon some on impermanence, but we will bring in dukkha or reactivity. It's like pushing away or grabbing hold of the present moment. That's the idea. And we will explore that this afternoon. And then tomorrow morning, we will look at, we will continue some with impermanence and dukkha. And impermanence is anicca, some of you know, in Pali language. But I think impermanence is okay as translation, but dukkha, I like to say dukkha, because translations are not so good in English. I don't know about Hebrew. But, and then anatta, we look at tomorrow morning. Usually translated in English as not self, so a little bit confusing. And that's the most confusing of the three. So that is, you know.
The most liberating.
Yeah, he said, where there is confusion, there is possibility for liberation. Yeah. And so we do look at that in the morning. Then tomorrow afternoon, we have some review and integration, and also how do we bring this into daily life? So that would be the, so there's some structure. Basically sitting and walking, you know, and often the beginning of each session, a short talk. We also have time for just to share how was the meditation, any questions, and so forth. So that's the notion. I think we have a lunch in, I think we will, do you usually have lunch in silence? Yeah, okay. So we have lunch in silence, but we have sharing, right? Sharing of food together, okay? And I think we have about 1 hour for lunch, so if you eat in half hour, if you want to, you could take a walk or, you know, take a nap. It's okay to take a nap in here?
Sure.
Yeah, you could lie down for a little bit, that's fine. Okay. So any questions about just practical details and what we will be doing. And then I wanted to also hear, I asked for to have intention in maybe a few words. And I want to hear just a few of them. Maybe I write them down also. Would anyone like to say your intentions just in one sentence or a few words? What is your intention? What brings you here? What is your hope for being here 2 days? Yeah.
And this last week was pretty messy for me, and I realized very easily derailed from the practice.
Yeah.
And to me, the intention was back to the center.
Yeah, to come back.
How easy it is to lose the mindfulness.
Yeah.
Really easy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, like, I'm okay, but
wasn't. Okay. Yeah. Tsuda. The other person?
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty much similar. I mean, it's kind of to come home to myself.
Yeah, to come home to yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many can relate to those first two? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so you would come whatever topic is.
There are some that I prefer, and besides, you know, there are lots of your teachings on Dharma Seed.
So oh, you listen. How many have heard me on Dharma Seed? Okay, just a few. Yeah, yeah. That was interesting. Yeah. Other, maybe a few more, please.
I was attracted to the concept of the non-self, and
yeah,
perhaps the relation to another kind of teaching of non-duality.
It
seems to me like it's the same, so I'm interested.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So I can. So that is the teaching of not-self, and interested in some other teachings, like of non-duality, which are there in teachings of the Buddha, maybe sometimes a little more central in some Tibetan practices and others, and many, many others. Now, how many are interested in that as well?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Okay. Yeah. Please.
I'm looking for clarity and confidence in making a decision.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm interested in how the practice applies to decision-making.
Yeah.
Like, because I'm used to it being in terms of accepting decisions that have already been made or things that are already present, and
yeah,
how to breathe through them, notice them, and release them, or watch them. And now I'm in a space where I want to understand. I don't know if it will be covered in this time. Maybe it can be something after. I don't know.
Well, maybe we can, you know, we can ask the question,
yeah,
as we proceed. It's not part of what I will talk about, but it's a very important topic. And you know, the general quick answer would be it's more like we get quiet, and all the mind going like that, we let it settle, and so we get to a deeper place, and sometimes the decision is clear.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so that's basic. So a suggestion would be, maybe for you, just stay with the retreat for the whole 2 days, and then maybe near the end tomorrow, maybe during walking meditation, just say, okay, where am I with my decision?
Mm-hmm.
And just see that. Rather, it's not so helpful to just keep thinking about it during the 2 days. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that's not so useful. But just, it's so because I don't know the decision, but maybe it can be clear, not so much from thinking a lot, but more from coming from a deeper place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Please.
I'm very interested in how this practice, as you said, implements itself in the daily life.
Yeah.
As a working mother,
yeah,
I do practice, but then I do feel the reactivity, as you said.
Yeah, yeah.
And the judgmental,
yeah,
mode of thinking.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to,
yeah,
learning, practicing.
Yeah, it's very, very important, you know. How many are interested in that? Yeah, daily life, and we will have opportunity. You know, I will give some instructions at 5 o'clock, just for the evening and the morning, because we can actually. I very much like retreats. We call them non-residential retreats, where you go home because you get to train during the day, and then you get to see how you are doing. In the evening and the morning, you know, And that's very good. So that's very important. Yeah. Sometimes I think that how we practice in daily life is the most important question, right? Because that's where our lives are, right? Yeah. Yeah, please.
I've been meaning to go abroad to ground myself, but I sort of realize that my mind travels with me wherever I go.
Yeah.
So I might as well do this grounding here and see where that takes
me. I shouldn't. Very good. Very good. There was a book, I think, maybe you know John Kabat-Zinn, who developed mindfulness space. He had a book called Wherever You Go, There You Are. Yeah, where you know the mind, you cannot leave the mind at home. Probably not a good idea anyway. And so so really to make it work here. Yeah. Okay, maybe one or two more, please.
It's similar to what has already been said, but I guess in a way from it, how do I integrate the higher or your personal perspective and my human small self in daily life?
Mm-hmm.
And how do I integrate the two perspectives in every decision making and every step I make in daily life? This integration to the best of my ability.
How do we bring our best wisdom and maybe love, compassion, and just with details of everyday life? And particularly, you know, what you were calling, what, small self? And the sort of the, and we look at that with the last part on not self. Yeah.
When you told her about going to the deeper voice,
yeah.
How do I get there?
How do you have the deeper voice? Yeah. How do you get to the deeper voice, and how do you have access to it?
Yeah,
that's a great question. How many would like answers to that? Short answer would be that it often we can it's not always this way, but often we can access the deeper voice in a protected environment like meditation, or maybe you go in the wilderness, you know, and you don't have the usual stimulation, you know, electronics and so forth. And you access it in special situations, and then you let it get stronger in retreat or in silent practice. And then when it's strong, when it's pretty strong, you try to then find ways to have it there be more and more just with ordinary activities. That's always, I think, in many traditions, that's been the strategy, that you first access in retreat or in meditation, you get it stronger. And again, basic principle of learning that you need, sometimes you need special training to get some to develop and to have capacity get stronger. And then you find ways to bring it into ordinary activities where things are more busy, more complex, you know, where we talk, and so forth. So it can be more challenging. Yeah. Maybe one more, if anyone wants to speak. Okay. Yeah, so welcome to people who have come in since we started. Again, my name is Donald Rothberg. I'm very pleased to be here. So I want to give a kind of a short overview, and a short overview, maybe take another 20-30 minutes, and then we will have a break and can use the bathroom. But if you need to use the bathroom, you can go. But if you can wait, that's a little better, if you can wait till the break. So we often ask the question, we may ask the question, if we are practicing insight meditation, what are our insights? You know, and I think there are many forms, because some of you know Vipassana, the translation usually in English is insight meditation. And it's organized around having insights. And there are series, really, of insights that have the intention of leading to freedom or liberation. So there's a, some of you know a book by an English teacher named Rob Rebea. People know his work? Yeah. And he has a very nice phrase for this kind of practice. He talks about seeing that frees, or we could say seeing that liberates. So we're interested in seeing clearly with the purposes of seeing where there is confusion or ignorance or old habits, and coming to not be dominated by old habits and patterns, right? And that to come to greater awareness and greater freedom. That is the aim. And so what kinds of insights are there? You know, from a very basic level, we practice some concentration, often with the breath, so we have the mind be less distracted, right? Because often our minds are go to one thing or the other. It's hard to see clearly when the mind is all over, you know, just wandering around. And so we develop first some degree of what we call settling or stability or concentration, samadhi, to help the mind be less distracted. So that's, for those who are newer, that is often what we start with. We start with some quieting of the mind so it's not just all over the place. And on the basis of that settling, we become able to see what is happening in the present moment more clearly. And first, when we first practice, it's nothing dramatic, you know. I sit, a little bit of quiet, I try to stay with the breath, and I notice my mind is going to planning. It's going to the past. It's going to something I want. It's going to a decision that I want to have. And when we first start practicing, we have insights into what are my patterns, what are my basic habits, you know, and we can see this, you know. So when I was first studying meditation, I had been a student in another country, and I didn't know whether I wanted to stay or come back to the U.S. And so I would go in, out, this country. Maybe half hour, then in, out, and then back and forth like that. You know. And then later when I practiced, I would see, I come from a family where people plan a lot. Yeah. And anyone have that too? Yeah, so they plan a lot. So often when my family would get together, before we would even say hello, we would talk about when we get together again. So a lot of planning. And in fact, my sister has a master's degree in planning. I'm sure here too, she has a degree in city planning. And you too? Yeah. And then later she went into health planning. And that's how she makes her living. She is an administrator for one of the health organizations larger in our area, you know. So I noticed I would meditate. I was a student at the time, and I would notice I had to give like a report in 3 days. I would meditate and I would plan my report like maybe 80 times, you know. That's probably very familiar, right? Right, I would plan many, many times. But if you had asked me before I meditate, do you plan a lot? I probably would have said no. So I didn't know my pattern. Right? And so some of the insight is to, these are my patterns. And it's one of the benefits, great benefits, especially near the beginning, you see these are my habits. And the purpose is to have a sense, these habits are helpful, these habits are not so helpful. You know, so I could see very clearly, I do not need to plan so much. You know? And I could say, instead of 80 times planning, maybe just 20 or less. So so I got to see, so that's part of what we see. That's some of the insights are about just seeing personal habits, just the way our minds work. And then we also start to open up to more general sense of insight. So we maybe As we go a little further, maybe we stay with, maybe I see, oh, look at the planning, I'm trying to find some security. You know, if I, in my mind, I think, oh, if I can really have everything planned, maybe I have more control. You know, and there's some, and I see, oh, that's something a little bit deeper. That's a deeper tendency. So we see that, or we start studying just the nature of different kinds of emotions and thoughts. Maybe, especially when we do retreats, sometimes we study very closely fear or sadness, you know, or self-judgment. You know, or I'm naming mostly more difficult ones, but maybe we also study joy. We see, oh, this is what joy looks like, or this is fear. And I know for me, when I was in my first years, I would sometimes do retreats, and there would be, I kind of alternate between very wonderful, beautiful, kind of the energy of the body opens up, oh, amazing, look at that. And then, or having, oh, my mind is quiet, everything is like shining in the world, you know, mind very quiet, oh, it's like everything looks like there's light, you know, in everything, you know, very beautiful, inspiring. And then I would have retreat like that, the next retreat, fear. You know, so I found personally sort of back and forth, you know. And I think it's good. If I just had one or the other, it would not be so good. So we learn about, I remember one retreat, I studied fear most of the day, maybe 12 or 15 hours a day for 10 days in a row. Yeah, but it was not real intense fear. It was such I could actually notice it. It was not, it was more, just more medium level. So I could study it, you know, and it was not too much. Yeah. So we see that, we see that we have those kind of insights. And a lot just comes from being mindful. We notice, and the whole idea is when you just keep noticing, insight develops. That's the whole basis for mindfulness. Like when we keep looking without trying to make this happen or this happen, when we just look carefully, wisdom develops. And there's also a way that we can look in very specific ways. And there are several kinds of insights which are taken to be especially liberating. And those are particularly the three for our retreat here. Like when you have insight into impermanence, it is understood as being deeply freeing, if you really look deeply, look carefully. And same thing, if you really look closely at dukkha, then this is also freeing or liberating. And in fact, looking closely at dukkha is the same thing as studying the Four Noble Truths, the first two, looking closely. So, and the Four Noble Truths, most of you know, is the most central teaching of the Buddha, right? And it's the teaching usually translated, there is suffering. I would say there is dukkha. There is a cause of dukkha. It is possible to end dukkha or reactivity, and here is the practical path. You know, so some of you know that that was based on the medical model of the time of the Buddha, which basically, very simple, says, the medical model says, what's the problem? What's the cause of the problem? What's the solution? And how do you get there? So a very simple model. So, and then looking into the nature of the self is a third area that when you, as you were saying, when you can really see clearly the nature of what we think our self is, it can be freeing. Because basically the idea is we actually can open up to something much bigger. We open up to a deeper sense, if you call it deeper sense of self or deeper identity. And we see how there is also a more narrow identity. And it's not so much a question of what the identity is, but what the mind does. Does the mind take the small identity and go poop? You know, like, could be like, I am a teacher. And I say, very good. I am a teacher. I'm a very good teacher. I hope people see I am a good teacher. Like that. That would be, it's not a problem to have an identity. I'm a teacher, I'm a mother, and so forth. But the problem we see is that when you grab hold of it, or push it away. Self-judgment, you push it away, right? Say, oh, this is how I am, not good. Right? And so these three together are actually taken to be the places of deep liberation when you go very much into them. And that's what we'll be doing for these 2 days. We'll be looking carefully and doing practices that you can take home. Because the idea is you really keep doing them. And these are really, in a way, lifelong practices. Yeah. And maybe a few other things to say. I think it can be helpful to see that the whole model here is that we aim for liberating insight. The aim is insight and understanding. And so, in a way, the most basic problem is ignorance. That's very important, I think in much of the world, there's often, some people say the basic problem is ignorance. Some say it's because some people are evil, And that can come out of many traditions, many religious traditions. And here, we have an emphasis on ignorance as the root of the problem, which is both, can be a lot, because you can, when you look at your own mind, you see how much ignorance there is. We see how we are living often in a bubble of constructed ideas, all the time. And so, and you look around and you see how people are just everyone is following habits, right? And they're following old patterns. And that can be, it's a lot. But ultimately, I think it's optimistic. It's actually thinking that you can take everything as learning, and that this is also a way to look at human beings. That it's possible to learn, and that even people who do very unskillful things, it's not because they are evil, but more because there's ignorance of a deep nature. Right? So, I remember there's a quotation from Mahayana tradition, from Shantideva. Anyone know Shantideva's work? Yeah. He is the favorite author of Dalai Lama, and of the Dalai Lama. And I think Dalai Lama, if you imagine a book by his bed, it would be Shantideva. And he says this. He says, this world is beset by insanity due to the efforts of those who are confused about themselves. So there's insanity in the world because people are confused about themselves. That's one way to say this. So again, it can be a lot, but there's something about that we don't see ourselves clearly. And this gets organized in societies, right? So there's a nice poem, or lines from a poem. Some of you know the poet from England, William Blake. He said this. He talks about how the doors of perception are dirty. He says, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to human beings as it is, infinite. For humans have closed themselves up till they see all things through narrow chinks of the cavern. So they're in the cave, and they see just through a little bit. They don't see like that. So our practice tries to have it be big. That's what we do. So just a little bit, I think, about the three characteristics. I'm calling these the three ways of seeing that liberate. Sometimes they're called the three characteristics of phenomena. I like the first a little bit better because these are actually ways of practicing that help free us. And But you'll see, if you read the books, you'll see the other language sometimes, which I don't like so much, because it makes it sound as if these are metaphysical properties of everything. Does that make sense? You know, it's like, okay, yeah. But when we say three ways of seeing, the emphasis is on practice rather than a metaphysical view. So I think that's better for practice. And I'll give one of my friends and co-teachers at Spirit Rock is, some of you maybe know Wes Nisker. Anyone know his work? Wes Nisker, named Scoop Nisker. He used to be working with alternative news, and he would give the news, and then he would end by saying, "And if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own." So he is a Dharma teacher. He is also a stand-up comedian. Okay. And so he says this. These are the three. So he's going to give the first. He's going to talk about dukkha, more like suffering. And then second, impermanence. And then third, not self. So this is more a little humorous. Okay. Okay. Life is hard. That's dukkha. Okay. It will put you through the changes. That's impermanence. But don't take it personally. Okay. So, there, impermanence is often where we start. And the Buddha says, if you could really see impermanence deeply and clearly, there would be no grasping, no ignorance. We would be liberated. It's very clear. And so it's a very deep practice, you know. And there's, let me see where this is. This is from some teachers who said once the 16th Karmapa, Tibetan teacher, who was a great teacher who died in 1980, and I met him, and he was a great teacher. He was invited to the U.S. Congress, meet the political leaders. Okay. So he goes, and they are busy, so one congressperson says, if you could summarize the teachings of Buddha in one sentence, how would you do that? He had time for one sentence. And this great Tibetan teacher said, if I had to summarize everything, I would say, everything changes. That's it. And also later, a great Zen teacher named Suzuki Roshi, some of you know him, the famous book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, he also was asked, can you explain all of Buddhism in one sentence? And he said, everything changes. So the same thing. And this is also from Tibetan tradition. This is from an ancient teacher, Geshe Potowa. He said, if you want to use a single Dharma practice, meditate on impermanence. That is the most important. Right? And so I will be structuring the impermanence in two ways. One of them is to look at what we would say impermanence in a gross way, and secondly, in a more subtle way. And so there are two kinds of practices on impermanence. The first is to just reflect on the fact that things change on a gross level. You know, we all change. We are young, we are middle-aged, we are older, we die. That is reality. You know, the seasons come and go, governments come and go, you know, all things come and go, and we can actually reflect on that just with ordinary thinking, you know, and to do that, and some of you may have done that. It's a practice in some traditions, in many traditions, to reflect on how things change. Again, not so much meditative, not so much with meditation, but just with thinking about it, reflection, right? And that can be very valuable. So we can really look like that. We can just, you know, one way to practice is to take 10 minutes every day and just think about how things change. Just again, ordinary way, nothing special. Just think, oh, this will change, this has changed. Maybe think about the past and so forth. Or you can, and that always is connected with thinking that also that I will die, you know, that I do not live forever. That, you know, because many times we like to think, I was talking with someone, I think we were talking maybe 2 days ago when I visited in Jerusalem with a person, and he was saying, I think something like, everything is impermanent except for me. We often think that, right? We often think that. So if you look carefully, you will find that. And so reflection, when you reflect on this, you will notice that you have that kind of idea, like, okay, impermanence, yes, yes, I can see, oh yes, the days change, day to night, oh yes, okay, I am impermanent, I don't think so, you know, so just reflecting on that in an ordinary way is a practice. You can do it 10 minutes every day. I did it once for 2 years, 10 minutes every day, and it's very helpful. You know, and again, we're not looking for anything special, but just to keep that as a regular practice, it will help. And to reflect on impermanence that way. There also are teachings where you use special phrases and you just bring those to mind. Like in the teachings of the Buddha, there are some phrases, I'll just read a few of these. You reflect. There's a text called 10 Subjects for Daily Reflection, which is... if anyone's interested, it's the Anguttara Nikaya 1048, if you want to look it up. Okay, 10 subjects for daily reflection. I have these on computer, so I could actually send them to Mikhail. She could send them to people here if you're interested. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. So you reflect on that every day. Another one, the days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? And so often when we look at impermanence, we ask a question, how should I live my life? We look at what we call priorities. That can be a fruit. And so there's also a way of practicing impermanence that we can say is more on a subtle level. That's more we explore through meditation. And so, again, it's more to see how our experience is changing moment to moment. And that's what we'll be doing just in a few moments, and maybe after the break we'll come and we'll work with looking at impermanence moment to moment. And so, very simple practices, anyone can do them. We first develop some stability of the mind, and then we look, what we'll do is we'll look at maybe one sense at a time. We work with sound. And you just notice how there is continual change of the sounds. You can even do it right now for 10 seconds. Then we start to notice how things arise, how they stay, and how they end. And you do that continually. You can do it with the different senses, do it with sound, do it with body sensations, can do it with thoughts and emotions. And when we train like this, when we do this for, you know, when we have a stable mind from settling, and then we look at the change, it can lead to insight. And eventually, you know, we actually see that all three of these are really very much connected. Because when you can have a perspective where you just see everything is changing, then you see, oh, out of this, I sort of develop a sense of self, where I take this from happening, you know, and I make something big of it, you know. We'll get to that. So these are the ways we can practice with impermanence, and we'll say some more later. And then with dukkha, we can also do a focus practice with dukkha. Now, I'll say a little bit about the understanding of dukkha. Again, dukkha is the word in Pali language that in English is usually translated as suffering, which I think is a confusing translation. And again, I don't know how it's translated in Hebrew. Is it
same?
Is it it's the word for suffering?
Yes, seven.
Yeah.
Dissatisfaction.
What?
Dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
Some kind of dissatisfaction.
Some kind of something painful or distressing. Yeah. Yeah. And I find that translation not so helpful. I like the translation of reactivity, really for two reasons. One is that in English at least there's not a clear difference between pain and suffering, and so when you say this leads to suffering, it's not clear it's not clear what it means, and the problem, and when we talk about having no more suffering, which is the goal, it doesn't make any sense we're not trying to get rid of pain. Pain is always there at times with human experience, right? But what is really being pointed to is whether pleasant, with the pleasant, we tend to grab hold, and with the unpleasant, we tend to push away. And there's one of my favorite teachings really makes this very clear, and this is the teaching called the Teaching of the Two Arrows. Does anyone know this teaching? Yeah, very, very fundamental teaching, and it goes so far. For me, it's actually even a clearer teaching of the same material as the Four Noble Truths. And here is the way the teaching goes. The Buddha was talking to a group of practitioners, and he asked them a question. He says, everyone experiences at times the unpleasant. How is a practitioner different from a non-practitioner? And so he said, yes, everyone at times experiences what is unpleasant. We can have unpleasant sensations in the body. We can have unpleasant emotions, unpleasant thoughts. We can, maybe we have unpleasant interactions with another person. You know, we can have, maybe sometimes we have injustice. We are treated unfairly. And all of these happen to everyone at times. He said, this is like being shot by an arrow. He said, this is the first arrow. We are sometimes shot by the first arrow. You know, some people more than others, but everyone at times has the unpleasant, right? But he said, here is the difference between a practitioner and a non-practitioner. And he said, we have to remember that we are non-practitioners when we are not practicing. So the non-practitioner means people who are just, going on habit, yeah. Okay, and it could mean us when we are just caught, right? And so he said, what the non-practitioner does when there is the first arrow is the non-practitioner tends to shoot a second arrow as if that would help. This is very common. And so I have unpleasant body sensations, and I often will tense around them, right? I will make tension in the body. And this causes actually more unpleasant sensations. We think that it's helping. But they actually found, for example, some of you know, you probably have studied mindfulness-based stress reduction. Anyone study that here? Yeah.
MBSR.
Yeah, MBSR. And so we know from studies of chronic pain, some types of chronic pain, we would say that there's the original pain, and that sometimes is as little as 20% of what people experience, that most of the pain, with a lot of chronic pain, is the tensing. Of course, we have thinking as well that makes comments on it, that can increase the pain. It's probably for most of us, this second arrow is much clearer with emotions or with our thinking. I have something happen I didn't like. I have negative thoughts for the next day or the next 2 weeks or the next 2 years, right? Or I have a difficult interaction with someone and I start, and I maybe judge the person negatively. I have negative thoughts. I have anger and a story, and that can, you know, something that happens in 10 seconds, I can have the second arrow again for 3 hours or 3 weeks. Right? That's the second arrow. Same thing with I have some injustice happen, and or I'm treated unfairly, and I can shoot the second arrow, and you know, and someone does something mean to me, negative to me, and I say I will get back and do that to the other person. Right? And of course that happens with countries and happens at all levels, right? And so many conflicts are all about the second arrow. Right? It's all about shooting second arrows at ourselves or at others. And so it's a very powerful teaching, isn't it? Very simple. Mm-hmm. Very simple. And it can really change how you look at the world. You can see, oh, you know, here's the first arrow, because what you want to do basically is, I won't go so much now into what you do with this, but you want eventually you want to learn not to shoot the second arrow and to try to deal with situations in a different way. And so, you know, I like to interpret what you find with the teachings about nonviolence, like Gandhi or Dr. Martin Luther King, very much, very similar teaching about the two arrows. We have received pain, we will not pass on the pain to others. The radical teaching, isn't it? It's a deep teaching. And so you can see how this goes all the way from very dealing with oneself all the way to larger issues, right? Same simple teaching. So that teaching helps to guide our practice. And I'll teach, I think, three kinds of practices with dukkha. One of them is just looking carefully for how when there is something pleasant, we tend to grab hold. And when we have something unpleasant, we tend to push away. And one thing I should say, in English, we would say that the first arrow is pain, and the second arrow is suffering. So this is making a technical definition, okay? And so suffering.
The second arrow is also optional.
What?
It's optional.
Yeah. What the aim is not to shoot the second arrow, right? But and so that's when we say that. Now you can see it makes some sense. What if you say the aim is to end suffering? It doesn't make sense if there's no difference between pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. Right? But we, and so another way we could say it is the aim is to not shoot the second arrow. And this is something we can study, or just shoot it as little as possible. You can study today and you can study tonight, because we always are shooting the second arrow in small ways. You know, so you can study it. And so I like the translation of dukkha as reactivity for two reasons. One of them, it makes very clear the difference between pain and suffering. And the reactivity is the suffering, or we could say it's resistance to present experience. Okay, we could say resistance, reactivity. And the second reason I like reactivity is that it makes clear that the problem isn't just with the unpleasant, but it also is with the pleasant, because the grabbing hold of the pleasant, grasping, that is a form of reactivity also. We are reacting to the present moment and saying, this is not good enough. You know, I need to grab hold and, you know, I need to have a second piece of cake, right? Rather than just, you know, have the first piece of cake and say, oh, this is pleasant, this is, I like this, you know. I once had a group, and I told them when we were studying this, there's no problem with the pleasant. And in fact, we could just eat chocolate all night at our meditation group. There would be no problem. And they said, let's do that next time. And so we did. We studied eating chocolate as meditation practice. Maybe later. Okay. And so we will do a few forms of practice with dukkha. We will look at how very commonly with the unpleasant it can lead to pushing away, to reactivity. We will study that in our own minds. That's something, again, we can do during in daily life. Very reactivity and studying reactivity is very, very easy to bring into daily life, because what we basically do is we have our radar and we look out for reactivity. And we can do that pretty easily. You just say, let me watch when I become reactive. And when that happens, I study it. And I try not to act on it. Right? And that's very, very basic practice. And you can do that all the time. You can have an intention in the morning, I will study reactivity today. You know, or I will try not to act on when I am reactive. Or I will, you know, I have a difficulty with another person, and instead of just like that, I will say, you know, try to, maybe I come back later when I am calm and I speak. You know, so there's a lot that, when we get more complicated, it's a lot to say. Okay, and so then we do, we can, one practice is we look at the unpleasant and we see how it can lead to pushing away. A second one is we just try to be aware when there is reactivity and study it. And then thirdly, we can also, I will say more about this, we can apply a teaching like Four Noble Truths. And we can say, oh, there is some reactivity right now. Okay, let's say I am getting hungry, or maybe I'm saying I need to go to the bathroom. When will Donald stop? You know, or something. And we notice we're getting reactive, right? And then we can say, okay, let me study it. Is there something unpleasant? Yes, I need to go to the bathroom. Is, you know, am I kind of grasping at that? Yes, I think it has to happen now. You know, and then can I let go? Okay, let me just, I can wait, it won't be very long. Okay, and so that would be an example. You just can do that in practice over and over. And this is, you can start to see how this becomes something we keep studying all the time. And as you study that more and more, it gets to be part of the way your mind works. You can see, you start to see reactivity or dukkha, you start to see impermanence. And then the last of these is anatta or not self. And this is the most confusing, and I will not try to say too much right now, but I will, we have anatta or not self tomorrow, and I'll talk more about that, but it is quite confusing. And then maybe I'll just show one part of the confusion. There, as you, I don't know, probably here too, but in the United States, there is a lot of what we call Jewish Buddhist humor. Do you have that? Jewish Buddhist humor. There,
we have American.
Huh? No, it's related, but there's a whole kind of humor, and this is one thing about not self. I'll just read this. The Torah says, "Love your neighbor as yourself." The Buddha says, "There is no self." So maybe we're off the hook. You get that? I'll come back. What I found from teaching this is that it can be very, very confusing. You know, and also I remembered one friend, they told me, a young man, he was told there was no self, which I think is bad translation. No self is bad translation. It should be not self. Very different. Just one letter makes a big difference. And a young man, he was told there's no self, and he was a student. And he got very upset, and he said, if there's no self, why should I go to school? And he actually dropped out, and I don't know what happened, you know. But he was very confused by this. And so there can be a lot of confusion. And I'll say more about that. But what I found from teaching it is I try to make it very kind of down to earth and simple. And I think for me, there are two ways of doing this. One is you can see that I think what is pointed to with the teaching of not-self, this is related to maybe what you were saying about non-duality, is that there is a way that we actually can experience moment to moment with no sense of self. And I think we actually do that a lot, but we maybe are not so aware. So if I'm maybe by the ocean, by the sea, and I'm just very connected, you know, and I'm just aware, and I'm not saying, oh, I should photograph this. I'm just very present, right? There can often be a sense of, you know, just there's no sense of self. Or maybe when we're with people we're close to and there's no self-consciousness or self-image, there can be just what we call a sense of flow. Do you know that word? Mm-hmm. And I think that's very close. So I think what is being pointed to is first a sense of how can you have experience without what I call a thick sense of self. I use that language, thick and thin, okay, and say, how can we experience without much sense of self? And we can do that in meditation. We also do this in daily life, and I think we actually do it a lot. Maybe you're just you're washing the dishes and just completely with the dishes, not thinking, nothing happening, no sense of self. It's actually, that's anatta. And then we can also cultivate it in meditation. And we can, and a lot of the practices, ancient practices, are about learning to experience without much or any sense of self. And so we'll work with those kind of practices. And the second is kind of the other side. We look out for when the self is thick. And we just study what I call the thick self. Study it over and over again. You know, what's it like in the body and so forth. So that's how we practice. Okay? So what we do, we'll do these 2 days. I've given a lot of the framework, and we'll mostly do practice from now on. But that, in those different ways with the three kinds of practice. Okay. We're ready for a break. But let me just ask any questions before we take a break.
Just something about the dishes, because when I'm doing the dishes, sometimes the same action can be just doing the dishes. Sometimes the same action, just a stream of the water or whatever, can become like it's amazing how active it can become, the mind, while doing the same activity, the same dishes, the same faucet, same.
So well, here,
are you going to deal with?
Yeah, we'll deal with everything. But especially what we're interested in is the sense of self. Mm-hmm. Because you can have a lot of thinking and not have much sense of self. Mm-hmm. That's what, and you can be with your thinking. This is really also non-duality. Mm-hmm. You can have a lot of thinking, but you don't have the second arrow. Right? Mm-hmm. You just have the thinking go on, and maybe in the thinking there can be a sense of self, but you don't add a sense of self to it. So you can, that's why in meditation we can just watch thoughts. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
You talk about studying.
Yeah.
Let's say I feel something agitated. Let's study it.
Yeah.
But I find it's in myself. I don't know about others.
Yeah.
It becomes like the studying itself becomes reactivity. Like I am trying to use the studying
right,
as a tool to control my life and feel good and avoid.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm stuck inside like a vicious cycle or paradox.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to get out of it.
Yeah. So this is the, everyone understand that this is the idea that we can use. It's not entirely bad. You know, maybe we use meditation at the beginning, and I say I want to use meditation so I can be more peaceful, right? Or I want to have my mind be more quiet, and maybe a sense of self, and I'm trying to have a little more control. And so it's not all bad, but at a certain point we want to look at that, and we want to learn. So the basic way we work with it is just being aware of it. Being aware of it and noticing that it's happening, and try to have an alternative way to proceed. So we will talk about that more. But it's basically just when you notice, there is a problem with using meditation maybe to control. And then we can just look at that, and that's the way things work. If we can have more mindfulness of these habits, the really deep ones take more time. So we'll continue with that. You can bring that up more, okay? Yeah, please.
I'm curious if you're using the teaching terminology of unconscious.
Yeah.
And like a lot of what does psychology use that? Unconscious behavior or unconscious mind?
Yeah.
Do you also relate to that in this vocabulary?
Yeah, I think it's, I think you don't really have an exact concept of the unconscious in Buddhism, but you have things that are close, you know. So when we talk about ignorance, you know, I think it means that in some ways we do not know, you know, we do not know things clearly. And so I think I use the concept of unconscious. But if it's not clear, you can ask a question as to what it means. But I think that, it, you know, it just basically means we do not know very clearly what our habits are. There are a lot of things we don't know. And, you know, I will refer sometimes to research on the brain, you know, and because the brain does not like consciousness. Do you know that? The brain likes everything to be habits. Much easier. Mm-hmm. You know? Much easier. Mm-hmm. If I do everything with habits, then I don't have to think and I can just... But there are problems with that. Okay. Yeah.
I like the reframing of suffering as reactivity.
Yeah.
And, but one of the questions I've had for a long time, and maybe it's too big to bring up here, but there's the grasping, and then there's the pushing away.
Yeah.
And I wonder about creativity. The creative responsiveness, as opposed to just those two, and how that. And how that is different from the activity.
Yeah. Well, let's. I won't give too much answer now, but let's bring that up again, because what we want to do is when we get to dukkha, we want to study what is dukkha. What is reactivity? And it basically means we're not free. You know, we are dominated by our habits, right? And so creativity is almost the opposite.
Right.
So creativity is involving some openness, you know, to experience where, in fact, I think that... I think there's a close connection between creativity and some kind of freedom of the mind. So I think so. Let's we continue with that. Okay. Anything else? There's not time for all the questions. It was just a starting framework. Okay. So let me see the time, and let's see. What I was going to do was to just take about 10 minutes. And then we would start with the first meditation. Okay, is that okay? So take 10 minutes. We'll stay in silence. You can take a walk or stand up or use the bathroom. I guess we just have one bathroom.